I'm at the only thing is that, oh, here we go. If we go, I'm conscious. I don't think anybody's due to come in a bar at any time soon, but it could end up that people come for an early pint. But I'm assuming it won't, so it should stay quiet. That's
Nice.
the only thing.
Well, there's the start of the pod. That's a pretty good start. I did one last night with Brian Moylett, and my mum, who doesn't understand pods, is just like in the background putting down this blind and then like answering her phone and stuff. So,
That's what would have been happening if I was at home.
yeah.
So that's why I came to this. Same came to a bar.
You well? Are you good?
Very good, mate. Yeah, very good. Thank you. How are you?
I'm good. The only thing I think of when I think of you is you wrestling Dan Cooper.
A great way to meet someone.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great way to get acquainted. It's just straight in.
And I
Double
think,
leg takedowns.
yeah. And I probably would pay good money to see it again.
Yeah, there you go. Get it going. Start the petition now. We'll do it at the rec.
What, like, do you want to do a quick intro and talk and say who you are and what you do
Yeah,
and
so I'm Tom Farrow. I'm a performance coach, which for me is, I suppose strength and conditioning would be the more well-known term, but for me, I prefer the term performance in its broadness. I worry that strength and conditioning makes you think of just like weights and running, where for me, the role we do is more about problem solving, or like physical performance coach, in the sense that you're specializing in the physical side of it, but we have to be really clear on how we connect all the other elements of that problem solving piece. So the technical, the tactical, the psychological. So I think it's really important that we don't get lost in our own little world of strength conditioning, because otherwise you can make, I suppose, things worse than making them better if you're just like this about your own little world, about here we are, we've made everyone really, really strong, but maybe they've not got better at their sport. So I'm a performance coach. Worked with a few different teams in football, in rugby, and a few other sports, athletics, canoeing. Being one of the most out there ones, a little it was a good experience. And director of Irite Performance, and so we're essentially a performance coaching company. Work with individuals, teams, schools, and do a bit of coach education as well. I
good.
need to refine my intro, don't I? I need to
No,
get my elevator intro isn't down to point yet.
it's better than mine. Yeah, as Fletcher always said, everyone should just be called a coach. Like, it's
Yeah, that's it. I like that. Yeah.
just like separate stuff out, don't we? It's and you've already mentioned problem solving a couple of times. Like, well, how come? Why do you think that's so important?
I suppose just like the way my mind works would always be asked, like, and why are we doing this? And why are we doing this? And that sort of, like, I suppose, like, goes out from a question perspective. So naturally, when I first started getting interested in strength and conditioning, I probably, or well, I think I didn't even know what it was till I was about 18, and then it was only just starting to become more popularized, I suppose, at that point. And I was playing a lot of different sports myself, like rugby, boxing, did bits of swimming and football, and then eventually wrestling when in my 20s. But I suppose because I went into it thinking, how can it help me be better at my sport? That was the question. So then when you're going through the education pathway, and there's sometimes quite a fixed idea of what strength conditioning is, and it may be put across to you in a, like, you have to do Olympic lifting, for example, was sort of put across as something that was almost like you had to do it. And I remember doing it for 6 months, and then I couldn't play rugby for 6 months because my wrists and elbows were smashed to pieces, and I obviously wasn't like flexible enough or able enough to perform that without it giving, like, I suppose, like smashing my joints up. So then you start to go, well, if this is going to be better at making me play rugby, but I'm not playing rugby for 6 months, that can't be a helpful thing. So the question started to start from there. The most practical form of the question, I suppose, when I first started wrestling, I was in my first year of uni. I went over to America, and I was training at some like S&C gyms over there, and I came across wrestlers for the first time as like athletes. And obviously, it's not very big over here, but it's massive in America, and they were just so impressive as athletes. So I thought, God, I'd love to do a bit of that, try that. So when I came back to London, went to the nearest wrestling club I could find. There's not many. And I think I was at some point in the session matched against a 60-kilogram Mongolian guy. I was about 105 kilograms and just got picked up and dropped on my head very quickly. And it sort of made me realize that, like strength is only as useful as being able to put it in the right place at the right time. And as much as like I may have been in theory stronger than him, I couldn't solve the problem of catching him, and he could certainly solve the problem of catching me. So I've always questioned out to find out, this whenever we give talks, we basically always start with the best players are the best players because they're the best players. So some are faster, some are fitter, some are stronger, some are more powerful, but the best ones solve the problems presented to them better than anyone else. And then that's that they know they take, they've got this very clear awareness of their own abilities. They've got a clear awareness of their opponent's abilities and then how to, I suppose, maximize their strengths and exploit the opponent's weaknesses. And it's a problem on what they really are at the end of the day is amazing problem solvers. And that's what I love about sport. And that's what I think drew me to it. And that's what sort of excites me about it and where my passion is in that thing.
Nice. I think you that's a good summary. But I'm not sure enough people start with the game and then work out what the problems the game's offering them, and then even start to even then think about like the game of the future and what problems that might give to them, which is obviously what we're trying to help our younger players with.
And I think if most people, if you're in strength conditioning long enough, or even just sport long enough, or you've played sport in any sport, any level, you'll know there's guys in your team who are amazing in the gym, but they're maybe not amazing on the pitch. And there'll be guys who are amazing on the pitch, and they never do anything in the gym, or they hate the gym, but they're really, really good players. And different sports require different, I suppose, like lower level entry points in terms of strength and power. And rugby, obviously, is something where you do need to have a certain level of strength and power. But I mean, there'll be plenty of players you can think of who
Zach
weren't
Mercer.
into the gym, and but they'd be absolutely monsters in how they play and understand their body. And like there's like these wrestlers, most of them didn't go to the gym; they just wrestled. But they knew where to put the strength at the right time in the right place, and that was much more important than having a lot of strength in general,
Yeah, it makes me think of I won't be able to say his name properly, but Jake Trebojevic, who was at Manly Seagulls. So I was over there in Jan, and I don't think he can bench press 100 kilos. He's played in 15 State of Origin games. I did say to him, with the body you have, I'm not sure you'd get picked for Clifton third team. And it's a bit like Zach Mercer as well, who like fit all the stereotypes of a back rower, would he? And yet is super effective in the game. I was thinking a bit about like tackling is a classic for me where we're not giving people enough like solutions to the problems the game gives them. So I wondered how you thought about like coaching tackling, because like what I see is sometimes not that close to like the problems the game has.
Yeah, exactly. I think the way we're taught to coach tackling at the most basic end is wrong, or just is not effective, essentially. I'm sure it gives something, but most kids are start off on their knees, and some guy's going to run at them, and they're going to wrap their hands around Ring of Steel, and close their eyes and hope for the best. And it's a very passive way to be taught to tackle, and the way you teach a double leg takedown in wrestling is much more active. So the guy you're taking down would be standing still, and then you're not just looking at a person, you're looking at hips and you're looking at knees and you're looking at angles, and you're able to break down the body. So rather than it just being this big body, it's joints, and they move in a certain way and it can be affected in a certain way. So I think that every kid should be taught double leg takedowns before they're taught tackling at movement. And that's something that in reality could start with 6-year-olds, because it's a very passive thing and it's a very technical thing. And then when they get to the point where kids are running at them at under nines or whatever, they've got half an idea of what they're looking for, instead of just going, oh, I'm just going to throw myself in front of them. And some kids will be very happy to throw themselves in front of them, but some less so. So I think that I wonder if it's because where wrestling's popular, rugby isn't necessarily popular, and vice versa. So I wonder if those two sports just haven't bumped into each other in the way they probably need to,
But
because
however, I bet they do in Georgia.
I imagine they do. I'd love to go and like see what that's like actually there, to see how much it's crossing over. I know I've just like Paul Emmerich was at Wasps and he was a great wrestler. Ed Warwick Lemer at Sevens, great wrestler as well. And they were unbelievable tacklers, And you'd think now, as it's getting bigger in America, maybe that's starting to cross over a little bit too. It definitely does within the NFL. But yeah, I'm not sure. But it's like tackling, like I call it contact skills. So one of the things I do alongside the performance coaching would be doing contact skills with rugby teams, and that is it is a skill, and you can break the game down into the different contact elements, the different tackles. You've got like choke tackles, chop tackles. Even like if someone's carrying low, like how you snap them down, you rucks, you've got rucks where you've got, we call about having like a window of opportunity where there's space between maybe like your head and the floor. And then there's where there's no window of opportunity when someone's already on the ball and you maybe got like half a split second to do something about it, or you've lost it. Like realistically now, as the game gets quicker and everyone gets so much more effective at that, if you're not there in support, you've got very, very little opportunity anyway. But even just mauls, and then what we do is break all those situations down into like their elements that build up to them. And at its most basic level, the contact skills is almost like basic gymnastics. Like how do you manage yourself? I always say, you want to learn to manage someone else's body, you better be able to learn your manage your own. And in rugby, I think there's very few teams that would be doing forward rolls and backward rolls in their warm up, but it's such a simple thing to include: bear crawls, carries. So at sevens, we used to do before warm ups, we'd have forward rolls, backward rolls, diving rolls, backward rolls of springs. And it's fun and it's playful, and it just gives them that basic understanding of how the body works in space.
Yeah, my sense is that there's lots of players that are learning contact who, yeah, as you said, like don't know how to move themselves really. They've like, or they're, yeah, just real basic movements, actually can't control their body well enough, and then aren't able to then dictate to like an attacker. Some stuff I wrote down while you were kind of speaking there, but even that, what do they look for in defense? Like, I remember we had a wrestling coach come in when we were at Rotherham, and he was about 80. And he was just like smashing people up.
There's some impressive people in the sport,
But
like
stuff
really
around
is.
pulling as well. So I played with Steve Surridge, who got one cap for the All Blacks at Cambridge, and he was the best defender I ever played with. And he was like a New Zealand judo. And he would, he would pull. He wasn't ginormous. He would just how to manipulate someone else's body. And then I had a great question actually when I was over in NZ with the Hurricanes. And one of the players, they were doing a defensive practice. And one of the players just said, "Oh, whereabouts on the pitch are we for this practice?" Because it makes a difference, doesn't it? So if you're near the try line, it's different. You're
That's
near
the
their try
context. That's it,
line.
context. Like,
Iconic.
what's the
So
context of this? And I think that the higher and higher levels you go in sport, the defining factor is like that tactical understanding. And when I say understanding, I think there's a big difference between what the mind understands, what the body understands. So when I think about coaching, I always think that, you might use the mind as a tool to get in the body to understand by explaining something, but ultimately it only matters what the body understands. So the body has to be able to solve the problem, because most of it's so quick, you don't have time to sit and break it down. A bit of a segue, I suppose, from there, but I think about coaching process and how much time we spend on the parts of the game we can explain just because we're able to explain them, rather than like the difficulty of finding any order or feel like we're doing anything in those senses that they're messy, which is what I love about your coaching and your approach, and that how you create those
Well, me
situations
and
where there's a lot of questions, but the questions are within the game, not just the questions, although I
yeah,
know that's part of it
I
as
think a
well.
session should be a question, but also like show me beat to tell me. The reality is, I could definitely tell you how to win a game of rugby. I definitely couldn't show you how to do it. But again, we confuse the two, don't we, as coaches? We're like, when someone answers a question for us, we're like, perfect, awesome, great work. We don't do it, and it's like,
No.
oh.
Exactly. Like, I could tell you a lot, but I couldn't do it, like, and
Yeah.
that's, that's the thing, this, and that's what I love about sport as a problem-solving creative space. Like, that's, we talk about the creativity side of it. That's what excites us. And it's a, athletes really are like these creators that are at the point of this moment-to-moment problem-solving that they have to go through. And it's an amazing thing when they do it well. And we're all, that's what we look, that's what we watch sport to see, like these amazing creative problems solved. And like, having worked in football most recently and being so impressed with like the skill level of them and their ability to solve problems in 360 degrees, the speed they have to solve it with, and then the technical foundation that underlies the ability to solve that problem. So that's when I'm thinking about the problem. So we always start with like this problem, right? So then with each athlete though, there's like, okay, what are they trying to achieve? But then with, and that's the moment. But within that, there's this technical, tactical, physical, and psychological. You can start to break it down. So if they don't solve the problem, you can start to ask questions. Okay, was it because tactically they don't know, or technically they don't have that technical ability, or physical, or is it a psychological thing? They just weren't in a good place for that game or that situation. And because if you start to do that, then instead of, you can be a little bit more pinpoint wherever you're focusing. Like sometimes might with a team, we might, it might be a bad game, and tactically, oh, tactically all over the place, da da da. Maybe they just weren't in the right place. Maybe they just were psychologically, for whatever reason, they just weren't in the right place for that game. So the tactics didn't work the way they could have worked, that, or maybe physically they did too much the week before and they're tired. Like, it's not always that you have to blow up the whole ship in order to
It's a
like
bit
figure out what
like
has happened.
it made me think of like often when people talk about communication, they'll go, "Oh, Rusty, how would you coach communication?" And I'll say, "All right, well, why is it not occurring?" It happened yesterday in the Premiership game. They spoke to the one of the coaches from the team that was losing, and said, "Oh, what were the messages at half time? Oh, we just need to make our one-on-ones." And I thought, "Oh, right, like there's quite a lot in that, isn't there? Like around like anticipation and." What did you do in the week? How much are the opponents surprising you? Is it just a physical thing? Is it psychological? Like there's.
How much time have they actually spent solving one-on-one problems versus doing structured drills? That's another, in terms of like, can we put them in these situations, and not just one-on-one, like you're saying there about the players asking a question, like within the context of how they're going to find that one-on-one situation in the game. And it might be at speed, and it might be under fatigue, and how often are they solving that problem? Like I say, like how often is the body solving a problem? Like every player at any level can probably tell you what they're supposed to do in a one-on-one situation, but actually doing it and reacting and being aware to and tuned to what the other player is doing. We did a talk the other day on speed and agility, and I put a video of Messi in there just because, as a player, the way he uses that, the way he solves problems, A, is amazing to watch, but B, like the way he pokes in order to get a response. And I think in some of the great performers, like the masters of their sport, the way they're able to, they're not going in there with a perceived idea, like a structured idea of how we're going to solve the problem. They're going in there with, if I do this and they do that, then I can do this. But if they do that, then I can also do this. So rather than going in, it's like, I'm expecting this very structured outcome. I can plan what's going to happen. You can't do that in most sports, So the great performers are able to almost be within the moment and not have to have a plan because they've got the technical ability and tactical awareness to solve the problem when they need to solve the problem. I'll tell you a Zen story, actually. I've got a good Zen story on that.
Go on then.
So it was about Alan Watts used to tell it. So essentially, when guys used to go and learn fencing, they'd go and live with the master. So the student would go and live with the master, and they'd be given like tasks to do around the house. So it'd be like washing the dishes or whatever, like cleaning. And the master would then like jump out on them with like a fake sword and like surprise them. Okay. And then, so that would go on for a little bit. So eventually then the student would start to get a little bit wise and then start to think, right, he's going to be around this corner. So I'm ready for him. He's going to jump out at me around this corner. And the student would think like jump out from the corner trying to catch the master out. The master wouldn't be there. And then the master would be behind him, smack him on the back of the head. So he's going through this whole process of trying to anticipate what the master's going to do. And eventually, after he never catches the master, he just becomes like completely lack of motivation to even try, and just goes back to doing his task and just thinks, well, whatever happens, I'll react. And then when the master sees that, he says, okay, we can stop the tasks now. Now you're ready to learn fencing. And that's so this idea that, while we're trying to anticipate what's going to happen, if a thing doesn't happen, then we've got to retreat in order to then go again. It's not the same thing as being able to just be in the moment and react to what we find. So I think that's what we're trying to, how do we get players to the point where they're able to be so in the moment that they're just at peace with reacting to what they find? And there's a lot of tactical, technical, physical, psychological development goes in to get players to that point.
Well, I was thinking, like when people are thinking about coaching, let's take tackling as an example. Like, how much are they thinking about deception? How much are they thinking about anticipation? How much are they thinking about your ability to dictate? Like all of this kind of tactical warfare, because we're a team sport, and I know that I love team sports. I'm not that excited about coaching individuals, but I do like the one-on-one tactical warfare that exists in wrestling, in boxing, in judo, but it does also exist in our game. It exists, even more obviously for props than it does. But also, like you'd be one-on-one against a certain winger, and you'll know that if you do this to them, you can then influence them in that way, and they're then going to think, which often we don't do enough in rugby. They don't look at themselves through the lens of the opponent, so they go, "Oh, what's Tom been? Where's Tom going to be hiding? Where does he think I think he's going to be hiding, and therefore where
Exactly.
will he then be hiding?"
Yeah.
So,
What does the defense want me to do
yeah.
versus, and that's like, especially with the younger guys coming into sevens, we used to have a lot where they'd be in an attacking situation and they'd, be trying to step, but they'd do about four or five steps before they just try and get past the guy, which probably at school level they maybe got away with because they were the best in the school. So they were like physically and just technically like a bit better. They could get away with it and maybe the defender wouldn't be as settled. But as a defender, that's the best thing you could hope for them to do is just almost basically stop in front of you and start chinking the legs. And if they've done that, a good defender will just take the space and tackle them. Whereas if you were just to do one movement to take the defender, put them under pressure, maybe you go as if you're going to go to the out. So the defender has to overcommit to that. Oh, oui. My guard dog there, stopping
Nice.
anyone from coming in the bar.
You
Well
may be
done.
thinking of Dan Norton there. So Norts, I just saw Instagram of him scoring a try, and they just described him as like a apex predator in attack, which is so true. Norts
Yeah,
was
he was amazing, and I talk about him a lot, which he enjoys, and the speed agility stuff because he's obviously the best guy to talk about him. But and his outputs were obviously amazing. He's very fast, but what made him special as a player was his balance and
yeah.
his understanding of how to unbalance his opponents. And his, how he played with speed. He wasn't always trying to run as fast as he could. He was playing with speed in order to move people around. And I saw that clip as well. And the one that I don't was it. I don't think that was a Carlin Isles one, but there was a Carlin Isles situation. It was a great situation because Carlin was faster than Noughts in a straight line. And but what in that attack, what Noughts did so well was just keep him off balance the whole time. In the same
Yeah.
way, like when a gazelle's running away from a cheetah, it's just trying to jink and jink and jink and just keep moving. Even though the cheetah in theory in a straight line is faster than the gazelle.
It's interesting because I'll do a lot of junior sessions and they'll all want to do contact. Like, it'll be like, when are we doing contact, Christy? And I'll go, okay, well, let's play a game. And like, you can rip the ball. And if you can hold the opponent up with the ball, it'll be a turnover. And they really struggle with it. And they're going, are we doing contact yet, then, Rusty? I'm like, you're not ready for contact. Like, maybe, and then again, my sense of spending a bit of time in football, and I'm sure yours the same, is there's just better movers in football.
They're amazing movers.
So we're not
Amazing
probably
movers. And I
spending.
wonder if that's like, I mean, one thing that surprised me in football, having seen this with my little boy, again, like starting rugby a little bit earlier than football. He probably started rugby around 3 or 4, and he started football around 5 or 6. But the kids that started the football at 3 or 4, the way they could move at 5 or 6 was like, oh my God. And I don't know if that's because they're having to anticipate to a ball, which is at their feet, which is a more complex skill than reacting to a ball at the hand. Or is it because football is just one of those sports where they're doing it 3 or 4 times a week already at such a young age because such a young focus on it? I'm not sure. But either way, the way they move and the way they, I think the difference basically in the games, like rugby's broadly played in front of you. So the problems are mostly in front of you, whereas the awareness you have to have in football, because it's 360 degrees, you have to be able to solve problems around. So I think any games in rugby where we can create those 360 degree scenarios will probably make better problem solvers because they're having to think like this rather than always up and down and what's in front of them.
Yeah, even like sometimes people say, oh, those 360 games, they're good warm-up games, aren't they? And I'm like, yeah, however, they're like, there's also some movement stuff that you would do in a 360 game that is likely to help you in a 180. And the reality of 180, especially if you're a certain player, probably a forward, is you will often be running north-south. I actually look at how poor some of the footwork, like the 5 yard, I'm always interested in what someone does 5 yards before contact, and like some of the stuff I've seen recently, it's like killing me. And then
Yeah.
I watched the Hurricanes had, there was a good stat at the weekend. I think it was about 30 minutes in against Highlanders, and the Highlander tackle success rate was 39% because they were just giving them problems that they couldn't solve.
Yeah, that's very cool. And then, like, I was thinking then, though, that so even though it's 180 degrees, it is, and it's played in front of you, but if you've got a 360 degree ability, your support is coming from behind you. So if you're used to playing at 360 degrees, like maybe you're going to be a little bit more aware of like what's going here and how do we play that, you know, and how do we exploit that and use that as an advantage.
And how did you, what was your time in football like? What type of impact do you feel like you had?
I think like it's different in different places. Like there's definitely a change in football in terms of like a movement towards what would be considered more like performance and bringing more ideas in maybe from outside of football. And I think on one side, I think the performance then has to be careful of not, you know, losing what's good within football. So you don't, and like anything, you don't want to go into somewhere and start going, I've got all these ideas, da, 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 not. So really the first 6 months or anything that you're involved in a new sport, you're sort of listening and watching and you're maybe nudging things towards like there might be some obvious stuff that you think you could improve from a processes perspective. And mostly it's like communication pathways. So a lot of what I was doing, I was head of department in sports science. So it's how do we make sure that A, players don't get injured? That's the first thing we're thinking about. And then we start to think about, okay, can we make them faster, stronger, fitter, and better at a sport, as I was saying. And so the first thing you're trying to do is like communication processes within the department and with the other departments. And are we clear with who's doing what and what do we need to get from that? So I think what the first place I was on was Wolves, and it was interesting because it was a new manager. I was new in the position, the new head physio, new head of performance and medicine with my boss. So it was a very new department, and there was a good blend of ideas between people who had been in football, people who had been in athletics, in rugby, in cycling, and it was very open. And the communication was amazing, and that enabled us quite quickly to develop some amazing processes in terms of just clarity and what's happened. And that's so important within like the chaos of team sports. Like, what's happened? Like, what have they done? And what are they going to do? Okay. And what are the risks with that? So, that's like my
Give
performance
me
head on.
an example of why you think that's like important, like versus and maybe why some people don't do that.
I suppose in order to do it, you need to be real clear of what you're trying to get out of the stuff you're looking at. So, for example, in sports science, we look at GPS a lot, and GPS is now most people quite far down the leagues would be having GPS now in most sports. But it seems like in a lot of times it can just be collecting numbers. We're collecting numbers and numbers have gone up and the numbers gone down. But what we really want to understand is what are the numbers showing us, and that all they are is a clue into what the tissues have experienced, what stress has a tissue undergone. And if you look at it like that, then you can start to say, okay, certain types of metrics. So for example, high speed running is going to challenge certain tissues like the hamstrings more than others. So then you can start to look at, okay, if we've done a lot of high speed running, we know specifically we're going to look at how are that hamstrings feeling. And that might mean that, and we know that in a game, for example, on a Saturday, they're going to do quite a lot of high speed running amongst other things that are also going to, there's going to be some key areas of stress. So that might be hamstrings and adductors. So on a match day plus two, we might just do some isometric testing, which is low risk, but gives us a little bit of an insight into where they're at physically relative to where they'd usually be at physically. And none of that really means much in like a one-off situation, but over time, when you start to see change, it starts to mean something in trends. And it just means that you can then go, right, okay, we know that if this player has done a lot and then they show up and their physical ability is a bit down on where they're at, and maybe a few other markers we see, maybe like the physios would have an MSK assessment on like range and just general what's the level of soreness. And if all these things then match that with the high stress of the high speed or the big volume in the game, that they're somewhat more fatigued, then we need to modify what they do in the next few days in order to make sure they're in a good place. That seems like a really simple thing. And in theory, that's what everyone's doing. But I feel like we've seen a lot of places is the communication pathways just aren't there. And it's more of like we're doing stuff to be doing stuff, but are we actually clear on why we're doing it? What do we want to get from it? And any of that stuff is a complete waste of time if you're not going to, it's not going to lead into how you make decisions. So I suppose what you're trying to do is just go, what information are we looking at? How are we sharing it so that it's simple and easy to share? And how are we reacting to what we find, whether it's one way or the other way? And making sure that every single thing we do, there's a feedback loop that's finished rather than just we're just doing stuff. So
Yeah.
that's the thing we was able to do collectively as a department within Wolves was amazing. And we had, I think, the lowest injury rates in the league. And they traditionally actually had low injury rates as a team. And I think that's as a department, they're used to communicating quite closely. So the people that have been there for a long time were used to communicating closely on everything. And sometimes it's a bit easier in the clubs that aren't as big because the buildings aren't as big. So people are sitting close together. You know the whole story about Steve Jobs and how he structured Pixar, I think it was. So he made sure the toilets were in the middle. So there's all this time where people would cross over and have these like conversations and almost like accidental conversations. And I'm a big believer in that in organizations as well. That how do we make sure that we've got the clarity in the conversations we need to have, but is there space also for like accidental conversations where you then start to link departments? So I remember just sitting at breakfast and chatting to the analyst about, oh, what are you doing here? And da, da, da. And then them talking to me about dashboards and things that I was working on. And then I was able to take a load of learnings from what they were doing and just apply it straight to what we were doing. Whereas in some places, the departments are so far apart, you barely even speak just because the building's big.
Yeah, my mate was head of performance in a Premier League club, and he said they never had a meeting with the coaches. Coaches always have like separate meetings, which, yeah, I guess my sense and GPS is probably a good one, is that people aren't individualizing it enough. They don't really understand what their intention is with it. They're not really sure which measure to use. I do like the pod I did with Jonesy, Simon Jones, who worked with Japan at the World Cup, came from netball, but they had just real clarity on what measures were going to make them a better rugby team, which again is like
And
quite important.
the same with GPS. You can look at, so there's two sides to it. You've got like protection, keeping them on the pitch, and then performance. So a lot of GPS is focused on protection, and that might be looking at volumes. But then you can look at performance in terms of, and I'm down at the Gaelic football stadium. The team we work with London, County of London, inter-county team. And one of the things we look at is like intensity of play within periods of the game. And then we try and replicate that within game type scenarios in training on a big pitch in foot. And this is one of the crazy things I think about a lot of sports, how hard it is to convince sometimes people to be like, just play the sport in its entirety, but make it fast. So instead of like the ball going dead, you're going to chuck another ball in and make it live. So you're trying to recreate the most intense versions of the game. And then people think about small-sided games and they go, oh, the small-sided games are really hard. Like they are hard, but they're hard in a different way to what the game is hard. And the players aren't having to cover space and they're not having to make reads. And more importantly, when they do that in the full version of the game, they're doing it within the context of their sport, but also the context of their position where they're usually going to find themselves. And actually, what that's doing isn't really like fitness as such, because you can get much more output from a running drill. It's efficiency. So how do they become efficient? And performance, really, and the great performers, like going back to them masters, is what they are, is efficient with their movement. Like Nautz is very efficient with his movement. And the body always really wants to find efficiency. It doesn't want to find this magical fitness, whatever that means. It's efficiency. It's just trying to become more efficient. It's trying to make its life easier. And I think those full pitch, high speed versions of the game are one of the best ways to get players at being really efficient at solving problems at speed, under fatigue, in the context of the sport, in the context of the position. And it's that simple. It doesn't have to be a fancy drill. It's just a game played fast.
Yeah, use a second ball.
And we use GPS to drive that as well. So we'll feed back on, okay, did we get higher than the highest periods we found within a game? And if we didn't, why didn't we? And you've got to be careful with it because you can obviously artificially make it. So like, okay, right, we're just going to keep chucking a ball down that end, then we're going to chuck a ball down that end. And then it becomes too disconnected from the game. So you're trying to have this little dance between tactical and physical on the when we do that. We don't do it all the time, but it's something that we look for and to get exposures to so that when the players are in that situation within a game, they've been there and they know what it feels like and they're able to make decisions.
Which is crazy that that wouldn't happen. Like, I see lots of stuff that I think, oh, like you're just so far from the game at this moment in points, like time. I'm not sure it's helpful.
No. And I think that's the thing. You've got to be able to, sometimes you're going to, but can you tell a story from why we're doing this and connect it to the game? Everything's got to be connected to the game. You know, even in our world of like strength conditioning and like physical performance, when you're doing this whatever mobility warm up prep drill, can you connect the dots from there to the game to the game? Not just because like, oh, it's good for your knees. Like, okay, right. And then what do you need your knees for? Like, what parts of the game are they important for? What movements and what's that story and how do you keep it connected? And that's what I think we always have to be doing because ultimately it comes back to that problem. Are we helping them solve the problem? And we never know. There's nowhere we go absolutely guaranteed we're going to solve the problem, but we can have some level of confidence that it's connected to the real thing.
Yeah, nice. And so what does your like what is it that you're doing now? What's your day-to-day type stuff look like?
So basically from the summer, so I finished with Chelsea and we've had myself and business partner Ian Taplin, Tappers. We've had it for 8 years and most of that time we've been sort of working full time in different positions. And it was getting to the point where it was sort of like knocking on the ceiling a little bit in terms of, and the thing that was going to take it to the next level or, you know, it was at that point where we could put our time into it, was having to put our time into it. So we've like, right, so from the summer, we're going to go full into this. We've got a new facility at Sunbury, which was we had a contract. We were working with London Irish, we was doing all their strength conditioning for the academy and the speed and agility for the first team before it went pop. So we were still training some of the players after they went into administration. The team went into administration. So and then the gym there was available. So we've got the gym there for the moment as we're figuring out the long term there as that plays out. But so that's really cool space to have. So we've got a few different groups down there, pro rugby groups, pro football, doing rehab camps down there. We've got teams based down there. We've got like team contracts with like London Gaelic we started working with in November, which has been amazing. New sport, Gaelic football. We didn't know
Cool
anything
sport,
about
eh?
it.
Cool
But it's
sport.
an amazing sport. And again, from a physical perspective, they have to be so fit. They have
Ridiculous.
to be fast. The problems are like, you know, the skill element of just even how the game plays out and the space they have to cover is amazing. So that's been really cool to be involved in that. So we're doing more team stuff and then we work with schools and we work with helping on developing their curriculum or just physical profiling processes, CPD for teachers and then coach education. So there's like a lot of stuff we're working across. I'm still doing like one-to-one stuff with players and little rehab camps and things like that and a bit of consulting. So it suits my personality to be in a lot of different places. So I'm enjoying that. But it's the first time we've been full into it and it's been really exciting. It's a mad adventure.
You're getting your dopamine hits from different stimuli. And the groups are like, I guess I was interested, like when I was over in New Zealand, Ruben Love flies over to Sydney to work with a sprint group. So,
Yeah.
I mean, this guy's probably going to play for the All Blacks this year, and he's like and again, I think in rugby, people are probably getting more serious about like a bit like the NFL, where they're going, actually, I might need to do some individual top rugby type stuff or have my program. You know, so that it suits me rather than it's just this mass produced thing. Is that
Yeah.
how that works?
Yeah, absolutely. Like obviously it's probably more prevalent in football. So we're a few footballers at the moment and that's been there a little bit longer than it is in rugby and we're definitely starting to have more of it with rugby players. And I think it sort of comes down to like the complexity of sport, having been in the full-time environments a lot, is there's so many players to take care of. So that's one challenge that they have within the full-time environments. But then also as a player, there can be a lot of change across departments if coaches go and the way things change and actually even the way the training is changes. So I think players are more often with the chaos within sport, sometimes looking for their own stability outside of that. And one of the things we do with pro players and semi-pro players is provide like a wraparound care in a sense. So that's part of like quality assurance on what they're doing with the program, just checking in, how they're feeling, is it working for them? Here's some extra bits they can do around it. With some of the part-time players, they'll come in, they'll spend 2 to 3 days a week with us in the mornings doing speed and agility work. Some of the pro guys then drop in on their weeks off and do some speed agility work, just little top-ups in season. There's so many different philosophies within teams about how they train that it can work for some players and not for others. You know, so some players want to get frequent speed exposure, but their team doesn't believe in that. So then they've got to sort of take that on themselves and take responsibility for themselves. And like players' careers are so short. That's the challenge they've got. You know, it's very, very short. It's very competitive. So I think more players are taking responsibility for the fact that they can take that into their control by having some outside advice and help. And that's certainly where we're trying to fit in. But I suppose one of our unique selling points would be the amount of experience we have with inside full-time sport. I think there's a lot of people who are provide care outside of sport, but they've not necessarily got the understanding of how it operates within it and the problems that the staff are trying to solve. So we're very conscious of not, we want to work alongside the staff. We want to be an extension of the staff and how they solve problems. But we've in theory got the everyone's got the best thing in mind, right? You want the best for the player to make sure that they can be in the best place possible to perform, which obviously the team has as well. And we don't want to butt heads on that necessarily. And it's really important as well that players understand and that, you know, you might want to get faster, but you can't get faster on your one day off a week. So people who come to us that we want to do a speed session and it's a what, you know, when do you want, like, and we're like, okay, when have you got time for that? And they'll say, well, I've got this day off here. Then we'd say, look, we don't want to do a speed session that day because you're just going to end up getting injured. If on your one rest day of a week, you're going to stick speed there. That's a terrible idea. So I think we're, there's definitely, I'd say, some like Instagram coaches that will just do whatever they need to do to get the, to show whatever looks cool. Like, we're definitely trying to, when we do cool stuff, we want to show people about it. But with the players, we're never going to recommend to them to do something that we know is at risk. And it's also counter to what the team would want to do with them on that day. If the team needs them to rest, it's because there's other stuff going on, you know, sessions either side of that that are going to be hard. So you can't then just plonk a speed session in the middle of it. So how we do that care is that we see it as like that wraparound care where it's advice and it's work when it needs to be work and it's rest when it needs to be rest and it's advice when it needs to be advice.
Yeah, the made me think about two things. One was about Mike Brown, who's probably like still playing at about 53, isn't he? And obviously, was doing a lot of stuff away from the club, and I think probably over time integrated that even better with the club stuff. And then the second one was, I just met a coach the other day who's at one of the top clubs in Europe, and they've got a new coach in, and he said, we only do 15 on 15 now. We
Yeah.
actually don't do small sided games.
Really,
And so, one person changes an organization and suddenly your training diet changes, doesn't it? So
And that has a physical effect, you know, and injuries within teams can be just because the whole the training the type of training has changed. So the tissues are getting stressed in a different way to what they're used to. And they'll be able to adapt to that because that's what tissues do, but it's going to take a period of time. So if it changes very quickly and it's quite intense, then it's going to catch up with people. And it's one of the challenges you have in pre-season is that players go from probably doing not much to then getting absolutely smashed. Like it's not going to work in terms of what they're used to. And I think especially in football now, more players in the off-season are making sure they spend at least a week, 2 weeks doing some work in their break. And we do that as well, off-season camps with players. And that's really to make sure that they can survive pre-season, you know, because it is, there's, in football, especially, it can go from 0 to 100 very, very quickly. Some of the biggest weeks they'll ever have in their entire year are the first 2 weeks they come back in from pre-season, which is sometimes following 4 to 5 weeks off. And there is the expectation that they do stuff to keep fit, but there's only so much you can replicate of a full team training session in a one-to-one setting. So it's increasingly challenging, like what players are getting exposed to. And I think the intensity and the expectation on teams to hit the ground running and that is on, obviously that's happening to managers as well as like the managers and then expecting that for players as well.
Not trying to sell your product, but even if you think about the school stuff, like in September is the highest rate of concussion because partly because it's hard grounds and it hasn't stopped raining for 3 months,
Yeah.
but also because I don't think we've conditioned players well enough for conduct, and
Yeah.
they arrive and they've had a short period of time, and then they go out and they get concussed in September. That's how it works. Like,
Yeah.
I guess especially you would be getting lots of queries around conduct stuff because it's super relevant at the moment.
I think it's massive, but I think it's one of those things that rugby still hasn't quite solved. And I think, you know, I think I first did the stuff with you at Sevens would have been about 2014, 15, I think.
No, before that, mate, is before that.
Was
That's
it?
yeah.
Yeah,
Well, I left
too
it
even
at
early
13.
then.
So
So then even
you were wrestling Dan Cooper before that.
Yeah, so then that's like, that was when I was still very much developing in the S&C world. And I think in theory, I could have gone all in and gone like, I'm just going to be the contact skills guy because I had this unique like ideas and product, I suppose, in a way. But what I didn't want to do is pigeonhole myself at that because I was interested in the bigger picture. Whereas now I'm much more comfortable like delivering contact skills stuff and we do contact skills seminars and stuff through Burrito. Because I think I understand where it fits in the bigger picture, because I took the time to develop that and not just I didn't want to get just pigeonholed as like a wrestling guy, like I was interested in sport in all of its glory. And as much as I love contact skills, it's one of my favorite things to coach. It's a lot of fun, especially when you get to take down Dan Cooper in the Lensbury. But it's part of a bigger thing. And that's, I think, the challenge is that I see what teams do with it is they bring in a judo guy or a wrestling guy or a MMA guy or jiu-jitsu guy, and they bring them in for a few weeks in pre-season, and it's just not realistic that they're going to learn like that. It's like an hour, and it's massively high risk. There's been situations I know of England have had in like many years gone by where players have had serious injuries from judo coach being in there, and I've got certain rules about how I do those skills. When I was developing all this, I was an intern at Wasps, so they were saying, can you do wrestling sessions with players? I'm like, yeah, but if I break any of these, there's no way you're giving me a job. So I had to be really careful about what stuff I took over, and then it developed through conversations with the coaches in terms of, like what problems are you seeing, and players, what problems are you seeing, where you find the pitch, and then gradually they'd come and say, oh, well, what would you do in this situation? And I'd think of it as a wrestling situation first within the rules, the constraints of the rules of rugby. So it's all developed like with that safety in mind. So one of the rules I'd have is like I would never ever do a drill where the goal is like an actual wrestling match where you start on your feet and the goal is to get down to the ground. Like I wouldn't do a competitive drill. I'd do drills where it's like, double leg takedowns and control technical drills, but I wouldn't do competitive drills like that because what I realized was that rugby players are extremely strong. And if you put them in a team environment where they're wrestling in front of each other, they're going to try the nuts off regardless of what you say about being careful. And it's massively, massively high risk. They're strong, but they don't understand how their bodies work. And it's just the risk reward just isn't worth it. Like you're doing a 1 hour session with a player, but you're going to lose someone from an ACL for a whole year. Like that's not worth it. So the point, part of the point of the contact skills is that players are less likely to get injured because they understand their bodies better and they're more effective with how they use their bodies. So what I think is best done is, drip it into a program over time. And what I've done work with teams in the past is then help them build a structure around their week. And where can it fit in? And what bits fit in here? And what bits can you do in rehab? What goes in warm-ups? What can go at conditioning at the end? So then instead of having like, here's a 1 hour session for 6 weeks in pre-season, and then we're never going to do it again, here's like 10 minutes in the warm-up. Here's 10 minutes within the tactical session or, more like condition games type perspective. Here's some stuff you can do at the end is conditioning. This is what you can do in rehab. And, and take the pieces and put them where they can fit around the program. So it's done all the time in the same way that we practice passing all the time, or we practice tackling. But obviously, full tackling is really challenging on a physical level to the body. So we can't just smash into each other every single day. Is even though in theory that would probably make us better at tackling, we can't do that. So the wrestling and the contact skills bit fill that gap between not doing it at all and smashing into each other, or smashing into tackle pads, which is, only relevant on a impact perspective. And I think people think about tackling as like contact skills finishes with the tackle. Like it doesn't, it finishes with the point the guy's on the floor and you're back on your feet and you're ready to do the next thing. That's when the contact skills finish. And that way we're taught to tackle with, like a passive, that's ingrained at such a young age that, you're on your knees and someone's gonna run into you, you're gonna grab and hold on and hope they go down eventually. It's such a passive way to tackle, whereas the most powerful thing you've got is your legs, and they need to be involved in the tackle until the guy's where you want him to be, on the floor or whatever, he's chucked the ball away or something like,
So maybe remember with sevens we used to measure only measure the tacklers like if you like got someone else onto the floor and you were able to then get up onto the floor that only
Yeah.
and then also
And
remember
Sevens is an amazing place to do that, right? Because it's like it's so important to have people on their feet. So you have to be tackle and get back on your feet so quickly.
well everyone should play sevens obviously
Yeah.
I'm biased but it was
Obviously.
Sam Jones that injured himself at 26 in an England judo session as well
Yeah, I
and
think
then
Ben
even
Hanford earlier than that.
sometimes. Sometimes people think about they don't think about the 5 meters before contact and how you're dictating and putting the opponent where you want to in order to effect a more, effective tackle. But that's
That's a
another.
whole other skill. And then, like, you know what you're saying about the masters and being able to solve problems as they find them. The better your contact skills, the more options you've got once you get to the point of the tackle. So you're less likely to have your head in the wrong place and stuff like
Oh,
that. Or you're
don't get
more
me.
likely to be able to adapt to what you find because you've got a whole toolbox of problem how you solve the problem. Like one of the things that's big in wrestling is single leg takedowns. No one ever tries to tackle with one leg. Like I always say with the kids when we're training the younger kids, like when it's a bigger kid, don't tackle two legs, tackle one leg. You know, and understand how you it, once you've got one leg, it's a lot easier to get the next leg. But you know, and that's something that I think isn't taught enough in tackling as well.
Yeah, true. Mate, if people want to get hold of you, where's the best place?
Probably on Instagram for Arite. So I think we're Arite Perform underscore HQ. There's a link to the website on there, arite-performance.com. I'm on Instagram, but mainly only for sunsets and stuff like that. So you can follow me there as well if you like. I'm on Twitter too, but I'm not very active on there. But definitely you can get in contact through there. I'll see it eventually. Yeah, but the website and the Arite page are probably the two best, the most active and where we actually see stuff.
Nice. I'll put a link on the podcast, mate. I appreciate you. I've got loads of notes. I've got a week of training this week, so I'm going to do lots of contact skills, and I'm going to be even more creative than I normally am.
Well, I love it. I always love chatting to you, mate. Really good to
Thank you.
chat. Thanks for having me.
Cheers, mate.
Thank you, man.